Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, author Mary Roach has a specialty of sorts. She writes about the funnier aspects of science. Along with the humor, she's known for her thorough research. Her books include Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, and now Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Roach says about herself, "I am not by trade or character a spotlight operator. I'm the goober with a flashlight, stumbling into corners and crannies, not looking for anything specific, but knowing when I've found it." Mary Roach spoke with Seattle Review of Books co-founder Paul Constant at Town Hall Seattle on June 15th. We're presenting the core of their talk here. You can hear the full program, including questions and answers, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. This event was sponsored by University Bookstore. Thanks to Anna Sophia Knauf for our recording. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. Here, Paul Constant kicks off the conversation.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, everyone. We have talked in the past, and you said, I think on several occasions, that you have no real scientific experience. That's right? I just want to sort of reiterate that fact.
Like degrees and that kind of thing. Yes. Yeah. I have a BA in psychology.
Okay. maybe you should be asking the questions. So you sort of learn as you go along, as you write a book, right? You don't go in with prior knowledge beyond anything you've learned from previous books. And I lost my question. It's right here somewhere. So how do you decide on a subject? How did you decide to write about military and grunt?
This topic came to me in not a very straightforward way. I was reporting a piece for Smithsonian Magazine on the world's, arguably the world's hottest chili pepper, and in India. And this pepper, someone told me when I was there, that had been weaponized by the Indian Defense Ministry. They'd made kind of like a pepper spray, but a powder, and sort of sustainably, locally grown peppers where they used. And so I felt that I needed to report on that aspect of this chili pepper. So I went to this lab in Assam, the state of Assam, India. And while I was there, there was the chili pepper, which they never deployed. They never used it because it was prone to mildew. So I never, it didn't work out. They shelved it. That was it. So, but while I was there, the lab director was working on a leech repellent, a substance, no leech repellent, there was no such thing, so they were testing various compounds, like going down to the river in monsoon season and rolling up their trousers and testing this leech repellent, and at that moment, I thought that military science might be more broader, esoteric, more roachable, if you will, than one might have imagined. So that's the seed was planted from that trip. And then when I came home, a reader wrote to me. He was a retired Army pathologist. And I, in a correspondence that we struck up, I said, I'm kind of thinking about military science. I don't know. The access was probably impossible. And he said, no, I don't think so. And he said, why don't you come out to Dover, I'll introduce you to people I know at the Dover is the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System. When anybody is killed in combat, the bodies come back to Dover, and there's a team of medical examiners. Anyway, so he introduced me there, and that's sort of where it began, and that's how it happened. Yeah,
okay.
I don't have any family in the military. My dad is really old. He was born in 1894. He's dead now, obviously. But he had, I know, yeah.
Your dad was, okay, all right.
That's... My dad was 65 when I was born.
Wow.
Anyway, so he came over here, and he enlisted in World War I, but he got a hernia during basic training, and that was it. That's the illustrious Roach military history. That's it. Yeah. Wow.
You previously wrote Packing to Mars about NASA. So were you shaking any of the same trees for contacts in this book?
No, there weren't any of the same folks that I had interviewed in NASA. My experience with NASA had made me think that access was going to be problematic for this book, because sometimes NASA was, for no real reason, a kind of just uncomfortable with me. I don't know. Why? I don't know. What's she up to? What does she want from us? What's she going to do?
Huh. And so how did that compare to the experience of this book?
I think maybe because of that experience, I started out, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, there is a public affairs office for books. And they don't, you can give them a proposal and kind of get a nod. It's not like they're going to open any doors. They can't make anybody talk to you, but they can sort of, they just say, yeah, we're kind of okay with this. I thought it would be a letter with a stamp and like gold embossed letter ribbons or something. It was just this hastily typed email that I could have, you know, deleted the not from and made it, yes, we are willing to support this. Just an email that I could forward to someone if they had any sort of concerns about, is this going to cause problems in my career? You know, am I going to get in trouble? But that, I think because of the NASA experience, I decided, let me just feel this out up front and see if it's going to be a problem. But people were actually very helpful. Because most of the work in this book doesn't get a lot of attention. You know, a lot of what is covered when people cover the military is you know, the scandals or the action, the drama, the combat. You know, not that many people are writing about military entomology or, you know, or the bioengineering or the, you know, that stuff kind of isn't on the public's radar. So I think they were actually fine with my writing about it.
Okay. And was your approach always to do the non-combat side of the military, or did you go in with a sort of a broader scope?
I had thought that I was going to embed, and I wasn't sure with whom, because there's not a lot of science going on out in the units that you might embed with. I thought I would embed with the 5th Marine Corps Dental Battalion, because I just loved the idea of a Marine Corps Dental Battalion. I pictured them coming down from the air with little picks and blue smocks, and that just tickled my fancy. But the Dental Battalion wasn't really anything going on for me to embed with them. So, I mean, they were a little perplexed, like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I want to embed with you. I want to follow you into action. So that didn't go anywhere. And then I thought, although it did, you know, I mean, I can now, it made me just as much fun to say the 5th Marine Corps Dental Battalion as to actually embed with them. So then I thought, well, I was going to embed with the Chaplain's Corps. Because when I was at U.S. Army Natick, where they make the food, the clothing, the backpacks, the tents, kind of the accessories of combat, there was a chaplain at Natick, and he had, you know, he gave me a little, there was a camouflage Bible, there were camouflage vestments for the priests, there was a little tiny, like, thumb drive Bible, there was a portable communion kit, and a containerized confessional, and I went, like, this kind of stuff I love. So I was supposed to be there reporting on uniforms, and I just kept going, like, can I go hang out with the chaplain again? and I was actually approved to go. And the chaplain, but the chaplains, what's interesting is that the chaplains go out with a unit, you know, say it's somebody, a unit that's doing road clearance where they're finding IEDs and getting rid of them. Sometimes they explode. And the chaplains go along. So they have this ability to empathize in a way. I mean, I'm not a religious person, and I wasn't so much fascinated by the religious element of what they do, but the fact that they put themselves at risk and go out with these units. And there's the chaplain, and then I love this. The chaplain does not carry a weapon. He doesn't have a rifle, but the chaplain's assistant covers the chaplain. It's like a kind of that covers the chaplain. So, and I, but part of me was kind of like, who covers Mary? Because if you embed, you got to buy your body armor, which I wasn't prepared for. There's a place that's sort of, it's like Trader Joe's, but it's like Soldier Joe's. It's kind of a, and it's, you can get used body armor cheap. And I'm like, do you want used body armor? I don't know. Anyway, so that was my that was the plan. But it was during the drawdown in Afghanistan, and there really wasn't a lot going on. And the U.S. Army approved it, but ISAF, which is the coalition group, nixed it because they were only sending daily journalists who were really specifically focused on what the missions were and not some goober who wanted to hang out with the chaplains. So anyway, I don't even know what your question was.
That's fine. So, I mean, it seems like it must have been difficult to get access to a submarine. Say at the mm-hmm. end of the book, you're on the submarine. That seems like it would be the sort of thing that they would not be very eager to have somebody who's written five books about.
That was about a year and a half of. I kind of end up stalking my subjects. That ended up happening because the director of research at the Naval Submarine Medical Research Lab in Groton had read one of my, maybe Stiff, I'm not sure what he had read, but, and he was due to retire the next year. And he said, you know, the Navy has a, we're very closed. We tend to just pull our wagons in a circle when somebody comes and asks questions. And that's what we do, and I don't see why we do it. We do good work here, and I think we should say yes to this. And I know a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but I'm retiring, and I don't give a shit. So he kept at it, and I, like, so for a year and a half, I, you know, every other week, I'm like, hey, Jerry, what's going on? Any closer? Anything I can do? You know, so it took a while, and it took a lot of, there were a lot of dead ends and backing up and trying somewhere else and kind of getting bounced. You know, we ended up having to go pretty high up the chain of command, and then when that was approved, then it was a matter of finding the individual commanding officer of a submarine who was willing to say, yeah, it'll be my submarine that this idiot can come on with her questions and her notebook and, you know, making a pest of herself, kicking someone out of their bunk. And, for 4 days, I think it was 4 days I was on board. The only reason it worked, because those subs are out, a ballistic missile submarine, this is a floating nuclear arsenal, and it's out at sea for months. Because it has a nuclear reactor as power, it doesn't have to come up and refuel. So no one, very few people, including me, know where it is. I don't know where I was. We went out for 8 hours from Kings Bay, Georgia, in the middle of the night. In the morning, this thing popped up. They laid down a gangplank, and myself, and it was five prospective commanding officers who were doing a practical exam for a few days. So I went along. I was able to go along with them. So that's how it came about. We finally found a way to, because there aren't very many short outings on a sub. They tend to be out for a long time.
Right.
So that's how. So just persistence, persistence, my boy.
Were you bummed that they didn't let you see the reactor?
No.
No,
I wasn't bummed at all that he didn't let me see the reactor. What does a reactor look like? I don't know. I think, but you know, it was because these prospective commanding officers were on board. They did all of these amazing run-throughs, tests, like simulations. They did a simulated attack, like we're going to launch all the missiles, which is just it was a pretend Armageddon. So that was really trippy and bizarre. I'm in the missile compartment is huge. I mean, submarines, there are two kinds. There's a small kind and a big kind. I was on the big kind because there's two rows of 20-some, silos with Trident missiles. And weirdly, because there's more crew than they can accommodate on there, a bunch of men sleeping between the missile silos. Because it's kind of the quiet, it's kind of like the stacks at a library. It's kind of a, it's just quiet, and there's nobody needs to be there unless they're pretending to launch all of the missiles. So that's kind of a nice place to sleep. Anyway, it was fascinating.
Yeah. I wonder if they call those Trump drills right now.
Yeah.
So it might be because I read the book this week. I said in my review on the site that it feels almost like a political act that you said in the beginning of the book that you weren't going to focus on guns in the course of the book. And you talked a little bit about this, but I'm wondering if there was a point where you realized that you didn't have to write about that, or if there was a decision that you made because glamorizing guns is very easy, and probably would have been a lot of people who'd be willing to talk to you about that.
Yes.
And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit specifically about the firearms part of the situation.
Right. Well, there are a number of reasons why I didn't. The book isn't about weapons and guns, partly because there's so many. I mean, the Discovery Channel does a lovely job of glamorizing high-tech weapons, as does Wired.com and lots of defense department websites. So that gets a lot of coverage. I'm not a technology gal. Mm-hmm. Bodies are my bag. Mm-hmm. I like to write about the human body, the human entity in, and sometimes in sort of extreme or unusual circumstances, like packing for Mars, mm-hmm. was human beings in an environment for which they didn't evolve. People evolved for Earth gravity and Earth atmosphere, and you take them out of that, and it's a real challenge to keep them alive and thriving. So I think that book is the closest to this book. It's similarly taking somebody and putting them in this extreme heat and with extreme exhaustion and noise and chaos and fear and just a tremendous load of stress and difficulty and how do you cope with that, and how does science make it maybe a little easier to deal with? So that to me was interesting. It's not partly because I'm more interested in the human side of things, but also because it doesn't get the coverage. Mm-hmm. That it's not the sexy part of the military. Mm-hmm. And also I don't want to glamorize weapons and bombs and killing. I hate that shit. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Yeah. Yeah, and there was a moment in the book. I was at Camp Pendleton where there's a group of military audiologists who were, because hearing loss is a huge issue. I mean, it's the number one VA expense. It's $1 billion a year. People come away with a lot of hearing loss. It's kind of an invisible problem. The showier stuff is the missing limbs and PTSD but hearing loss is huge, and it's incredibly common. And it's kind of a challenge because, it's easy to protect hearing, but if you're a soldier, your situational awareness comes, 50% of it is from your hearing. So they don't want to protect their ears. They'd rather save their lives than save their hearing. So, how do you protect hearing and not compromise someone's safety? So anyway, I was at Camp Pendleton for this sort of a tactical demonstration thing with the military audiologists, and there were some Marine Corps special operations guys who were taking them out on a demonstration of this technology, which could facilitate communication but also protect the ears. Mm-hmm. And part of that, there was a segment of it where we were firing M16s, which I think it was sort of like, hey, military audiologists, come fire M16s with special operations guys, and sort of, like, it was sort of a bait, I think, which kind of worked for me too, because I've never fired a gun, and on the one hand it was, it's target practice, hitting a target and the whole thing. I mean, it's kind of fun, but it's really chilling that it's fun, and part of me, I was very aware when I was writing it up that this. I ended up talking about just the act of pulling a trigger and how the verbs that you use are squeeze or pull, when really it's just a twitch. Mm-hmm. It just seems so wrong that, like, to take a human life could be just this, just little, you know. It just felt like it should have a little more muscle to it. I don't know. Just that you could just so cavalierly. Anyway.
It's easier to flip somebody off than it is.
Exactly. So, yeah. I mean, Guns. So there is that scene, but I was very aware of not, even though it was like, I hit the target, but that's like, this is not an arcade game. This is an M16 rifle, semi-automatic rifle, and it was a chilling demonstration of how, you know, people can get sucked into the kind of the game and the thrill and the fun of firing guns. And it's, you know, I was on a shooting range, but I don't know, especially with the events of this week. The chicken gun is more my speed. Yeah. The chicken gun fires thawed supermarket chickens at jet canopies just to for birds protection, you know, making sure that they withstand bird strike if you hit a bird. Anyway, the chicken gun. That's as far into guns as I want to get.
Unfortunately, the chickens aren't alive because I like to envision the sound. They weren't alive, right?
It's very Far Side.
Or Muppet Show, I was thinking. Yeah. Either one works, I think. Were these people, because you talk about the relationship of this book to Packing with Mars, which I can totally see, but Packing for Mars sort of plays into that whole journeying out and exploration and all that, whereas this one, a lot of the people you talk to are employed by a complex, like a military-industrial complex, to do the exact opposite of what the military-industrial complex wants to do. They are repairing the harm to bodies that is supposed to be done. Was there any sort of a thread between the people who worked? Did they all have a similar sense of humor or a heightened sense of irony or something like that?
I think, you know, in the back of my mind was always, as an organization, the military has historically and currently puts a lot of effort into keeping people alive to finish the mission, to finish the job when the job is killing. And that irony is very present in my mind. But I think that the people, you know, if you're a surgeon and you're seeing people coming in maimed and blown apart day after day, your focus is on life, saving those lives, and that's, you know, and I think they see that as a worthwhile mission, and, you know, that they don't cut that isn't preying on their mind in the same way that, you know, we're keeping them alive to put them back out there. I think they're just like, let's freaking save this guy's life. Mm-hmm. And most of the, you know, people at the Armed Forces Medical Examiner system, these are not fans of war. You know, these folks, I mean, they, you know, 6,000 autopsies since, I don't know, 2003, something like that. Anyway, they're not fans of war. Some of the most fervent anti-war people you'll find are in the military, specifically in the communities that I was in. Mm-hmm. The pathologists, the medical examiners, the surgeons, the people who deal with the consequences of it.
Anyway, on to stink bombs. Writing about smell is especially tricky, and it's something that I think a lot of people don't realize until they try to write about a smell. You do a really, really good job in the chapter on the various types of stink bombs. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that experience, or if you disagree with me, in fact, that writing about smell is weird.
Writing about smell, particularly writing about very foul smells, overwhelmingly awful smells, it's very hard to describe in words the sensation of smelling stench soup, which is a contemporary malodorant, is the current terminology for it. It's a non-lethal weapon. It's to clear a compound or to disperse a mob. It's not harmful to people, but it is unbelievably smelly and horrible and revolting. And it is so hard that after I left the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, did this work in the late 1990s to come up with this universally loathed smell, and they went around the world with these like sewage, burnt hair, vomit, U.S. government standard bathroom malodor. So like taking them around to different cultures, going, "What do you think of this?" And the questionnaire wasn't just like, "Do you find this appealing?" They had things like, "Is this a wearable odor? Is this an edible odor?" And almost all of them, you could find a culture that would go, "Yeah, I'd wear that. Yeah, a little bit right here." Yeah. Something like 3% of Caucasians found vomit smell to be an edible smell, I think. But the one that won was U.S. government standard bathroom malodor, which was developed after World War II for the purpose of testing latrine deodorizing compounds. So they needed something, a standardized, horrible latrine smell. And that one, around the world, people hated. They thought it was scary, dangerous, horrific. Anyway, to get to your specific question, I smelled a lot of these while I was at Monell Chemical Senses Center. They had them under a fume hood, and they'd open it up and kind of like stand back. But when I came home, and I was a couple months later writing the chapter, I couldn't remember the smells, and I had taken notes, and my notes would just go like, "Ew, horrible!" Like I couldn't really find words for it, so I had them send me. These samples, which I then opened up out on our deck, because I thought, "Oh well, I'll open it up outside." But you couldn't go out on the deck for 2 days. I mean, just really horrible. My husband's like, "What have you done? This is never going to go away." I'm not a gaggy person. I rarely, as you can imagine, I rarely gag. I gagged. Just over some of the butyric acid, which is in kind of a small dose, smells like Parmesan cheese. But it's one of those context things: Parmesan cheese or vomit, depending on and appealing or not appealing depending on the circumstances. Same with trimethylamine, which is a fishy odor or kind of a lady's odor. And one of the papers, they were World War II papers, the guy said, "Pleasant or unpleasant depending on circumstances." I love that. But anyway, describing stench soup or who me, the World War II one, I don't feel I did a very good job of it. I almost took out the description I have because it felt lame. It is very hard to write about smells. Mm-hmm. In the same way, years ago, I reported a piece for National Geographic on chimpanzees on the savannah chimpanzees, and a chimp is their expressions and their behavior. It wants to be filmed. It's a visual thing, and to try to capture the expression or the antics of a chimp in words, I just felt like I kept failing over and over. Certain things either need to be seen or smelled, and not written about.
Military research often bears fruit in sort of consumer technology and in daily life. Did you see anything in the course of writing this book that you think we will be seeing pretty soon, either on the shelves or in the course of an average day?
I'm hoping that we don't see caffeinated meat.
Yeah.
Because I tried caffeinated meat, and it tastes the way caffeinated meat, you'd think the caffeinated meat would taste. One thing that was kind of cool, they were at Natick Labs in Massachusetts, the accessories people. They had uniforms, accessories.
The accessories people, that's
accessories
a great tagline,
people.
I think.
I know, that should be their little thing. Yeah. We're the accessories people. They had shirts with these that were, I forget the exact technology, but I don't think it was solar, but the shirt, maybe it was solar, but it was a panel in the clothing that you could be charged, that would, you could sort of plug your, you could charge your phone or your computer with your shirt, which I thought, I mean, they probably weren't very attractive shirts, but for camping, I don't know, it just seemed like kind of wearable, a wearable charger seemed kind of like a cool thing to have. A lot of the most impressive stuff is comes out of combat trauma care, like intense first aid, like improved tourniquets or a better needle for chest decompression if somebody's shot in the lung. If you're shot in the lung and you inhale, the air starts building up outside the lung, and then you can't inhale. So it's a matter of taking a needle and sticking it in and relieving that pressure. And for and one of the things, there's this program called Feedback to the Field at the morgue, where they have these teleconferences between the medical examiners and the people who rendered the care in the field. And then there's a slide of the person who had died, and they leave on all the life-saving equipment. It all stays, it's part of the autopsy. And that way they can figure out, is there anything we could have done differently here? Are we seeing the same problems over and over? Are people putting the tourniquet on in the right place? Are they making any mistakes over and over? And one of the things they figured out was that because there are so many soldiers who do weightlifting and bodybuilding as a pastime there, that their chests were so, their muscles were so developed that the needles weren't making their way to the lung, to the chest. They were like barely clearing the muscle. So, and now they use longer needles. So just, so it's, you know, and that, rather than waiting for it to be published in a journal, they'd have these teleconferences, and the feedback to the people in Afghanistan who are doing the care, it happens really quickly. So, and then that makes its way into emergency care. And you know, so I think that the medical world, there's a lot of, you know, it's too bad that's how we are learning things, but that's a lot of advances and improvements in emergency medical care have come out of the military.
That never occurred to me. Is that part of the reason why military research moves so far ahead, because they don't have the sort of regulation periods that other sciences do?
Oh, you mean because they're not waiting for publication and that kind of thing?
Yeah, they're not waiting for publication.
Well, for a long time they did, and I think it's, you know, the word gets back to the people overseas. I don't know how quickly. I mean, I think they then do publish a paper, so I think it does make its plodding way back to civilian emergency care journals, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there a point, I guess, in the course of writing this book, but also just when you're writing a book, because you've done a few of these now, you've done a half dozen of these, is there a point where you suddenly feel confident in your knowledge of the general subject? Is there a point where your brain is full, for lack of a better term?
No, I don't ever feel confident. I always, because I have this annoying habit of, if every book I start over again, instead of building on the knowledge that I gained from one book and then being a better informed, smarter person as I go into the next book, I start completely over as an ignoramus. And I come a long way from ignoramushood, but I'm still so far from being somebody who really knows what they're talking about. I always feel like I'm skating on thin ice, and that I'm, you know, I may have the details right, but my lack of a background may cause me to say something that's kind of technically accurate, but if you know the stuff, you'll go, well, yeah, but kind of. But so, no, but I never launch a book feeling confident, yeah, I'm such an expert on this. I always launch a book thinking, I will get some feedback that will help me to make the paperback more accurate.
What is the correction process like? Because I know, I mean, anytime you publish an article, there's always going to be a mistake
yes.
in it. And there's often an email where somebody's like, I really like this piece, but is
yes.
always, yeah.
Yes.
So you must get some crazy ones, crazy emails like that after you publish.
I think my favorite was when Stiff came out, I got a letter from Dr. Kevorkian's assistant. And I had written about, before Dr. Death became known as Dr. Death, before he was doing euthanasia, he was working on a project of transfusing cadaver blood, you know, trying to figure out how long after death is this blood viable for transfusion, and are we wasting a lot of blood that we could be using? And he wrote a paper, and it kind of sounded like he went ahead and transfused some cadaver blood into some living people without telling them. And it seemed like you might want to let them know. Anyway, I mentioned that, and Dr. Kevorkian's assistant wrote and said, I really enjoyed your book. However, you made it sound like we didn't get permission, and we did actually get consent. And then he said, and I'm going to be sending a copy of your book to Dr. Kevorkian in the Thumb Correctional Facility. And I kept waiting for the letter from Dr. Kevorkian, and I never did hear from him.
No.
People are very nice about it. You know, I really enjoyed the book. Just by the way, a scuba tank does not contain oxygen. It contains air. If it had oxygen, you'd be in trouble. So little, you know, just it's often, it's things I should have known. Like I actually knew that, but it's just, they kind of dribble in over the first few months and you keep a folder of them and you send them to the, to your editor and then they fix them for the paperback, and hopefully the paperback has everything right. Yeah.
Right. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight. Thank you, Mary Roach, for being here tonight with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this podcast of a talk with author Mary Roach on Speakers Forum. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Anna Sophia Knuff for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.